Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Jerry Merskin. Merskin is an associate professor of writing at Ithaca College. His poetry has appeared in dozens of literary journals and anthologies, including Seneca Review, Prairie Schooner, Midwest Quarterly, Main Street Rag, and Oklahoma Review. He is the author of two collections of poetry. His first, Picture a Gate Hanging Open and Let That Gate Be the Sun, was published in 2002 by Mammoth Books after winning first prize in their national competition. His second collection is called In Flagrante Delecto, published in 2008, also by Mammoth Books. And welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thanks, Tish.
Now, I want to talk about your childhood. Did you discover poetry as a child, or did that come later?
No, that certainly came later. In fact, I think there was a key moment for me. I took a class as an undergraduate, but it wasn't until later when I kind of needed poetry that it kind of appeared to me. I was working in construction, and I was in this house, and somehow it was just a point in my life where I had enough of construction, but I didn't know what else I needed. We were at lunchtime, and I went into one of the rooms, and the house was covered with dust from all the construction, and there was a mirror there, and somehow just my hand went up, and I started to write a poem that I remembered from my undergraduate days, written by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and uh-huh. I wrote it on the mirror.
Wow, in the dust.
Yeah,
in the dust. How poetic.
Yeah, and then I sort of stopped and said, gee, there's something that's missing, and I think I know what it is now. And then I went back to school. I thought I'd be a high school English teacher. But in that sanctuary of graduate school, I discovered that I had the time to sort of really delve into literature and really started to find a sort of partner in reality for me.
Uh-huh. What were really some of your first subjects that you were writing about? Just everyday life?
It's interesting you should say that, because I think I've discovered a pattern for male poets that in their 20s they write about death, then in their 30s they write about birds, and then 40s they write about trees. And now that I'm in my 50s, I discovered that poets write about flowers. but not only flowers, but old girlfriends. That seems to be a theme for poets in their 50s. So, I think my original topics were those concerns, that sort of came about with an awareness of mortality. That sort of pressed reality and its preciousness into my consciousness in a way that hadn't been there.
Uh-huh. And did you find comfort? Is that, do you think, what you were looking for?
Yeah, I'd say comfort or consolation or just sort of expression itself. I think that's what art does. It consoles. Mm-hmm. In understanding, there's a kind of liberation, at least, for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, temporary.
Yeah.
Interesting. You say you also worked as a herdsman for a dairy farm. Did that bring out poetry in you as well? It sounds like a romantic thing up on the hills, constructing poems.
I have a poem where I refer to that time as it wasn't any more romantic than taking a shower with your clothes on. It was a very physical time of life for me, and I think you find that a lot of poets draw on their sort of strong physical relationship with the world. And I just needed that. I'd been in school for 4 years, and that's fun. But then I needed a more immediate relationship with the world. So I worked on a farm for a year, and then I worked in construction for 4 years. I think that was a powerful time for me. And then I did write about it, not at the time, but later in reflection.
Uh-huh. Well, to tell us how you construct your poems, are you one of those guys that's walking around in your daily life and you think of a line and you have to immediately write it down, or do things come in whole pieces? How does it work?
I would say that writers are people who write, who sit there at work on a regular basis. But once you do that, you create a kind of continuity, and the poetry becomes a partner to your living. And then when you're thinking, walking, living, lines come to you. I might scribble down a few things. That's very common for writers to have a poem that started on the back of an envelope. But they're also writing on a daily basis, too. So I think it's more of a matter of sitting there working, creating a kind of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
A little less inspiration.
Uh-huh. Well, you seem to create some beautiful poetry just out of everyday life. Did it take you a while to develop that, thinking that perhaps I should be more profound in my construction instead of just from everyday life?
Most poets would say that, it's sort of seeing the extraordinary in the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But you're asking an interesting question. It's sort of the difference between William Carlos Williams and Wallace Stevens, who are contemporaries, and William Carlos Williams saying, "See, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens." You know, basically, let's find it in ordinary life, in the things of the world. And then you have Wallace Stevens, who's, a very abstract philosophical poet, more sophisticated, but still sort of, I think, trying to find the extraordinary in the ordinary, but in a kind of more erudite language and sensibility.
I think it's a real art to make it accessible, too. A lot of poets try to make things complicated.
Yeah, I think that was one of my main concerns. I think that might have had to do with having had such a good time, working in construction with other guys, and I wanted to continue being able to talk to people I admired. I wanted to be able to talk to my fellow workers. I wanted to talk to my father, my mother, my friends, my father's friends, those old geezers. I wanted them to understand what I was saying. I didn't want it to live on the page in the academy.
Yeah.
And so that was a challenge, and I worked hard at that. I used to practice reciting my poems in a laundromat in Binghamton when I first started, just to be in that public space, trying to say something that I felt was true that I could say. And the laundromat was the perfect place because no one could hear me. So I could practice, but they were there. And it was important to me.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, on that note, I want you to read a piece from In Flagrante.
In Flagrante Delicto.
That's a hard one to say. This poem is called Cooperation.
Like that poem. I hardly read that, so it's nice that you asked.
To tell us a little bit about it. I liked it because it has to do with the here and now as well as thought-provoking history that you bring up.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because the poem arrives at a place that is pretty wedded to this world, but it begins in a kind of meditation about that something which sustains us, that's sort of almost behind the scenes. Sometimes we think about creation as beginning billions of years ago in a big bang. This poem begins with a meditation of how whatever initiates and sustains being is doing that in the present. And continues in the present. But I don't think that actually comes through. It's such an abstract idea. But that's where it starts. And the idea of cooperation is almost like an electron following an electron, ad infinitum, in the present.
Building something, yeah.
So I'd be happy to read that one, Cooperation. As if behind the screen, firm, resolved, knowing or not, there is great cooperation. Look at the workers over there, how they stand and look away, courteously cupping their cigarettes, combing their hair that has become wet in the rain. Or how the young rabbi explains the Hebrew word for cemetery means house of worlds, and a city of stones crops up, sentient and oblique. The last thing she said to me was live. She said it three times. She was my beginning in America. The fur of her coat, the kisses kissed, hands waving over candles on the stove. I need one life to live and one to be nostalgic. Nostalgic for the crumbs of her semi-sweet cookies, for the tone of pogrom that was always in her voice. Live, she said, sitting in a wheelchair outside her building in the Bronx. Her blue eyes neither sea nor sky. The rabbi beckons us to come forward, to take part, take shovel. For real, he says, not symbolic. My grandmother's words board a train, then a ship. They take passage for a time on the infinity of waves. When they arrive, they fill out forms. Listen, what I'm trying to say is she did not tell me to be happy or gentle or loving or good. Burying, the rabbi said, is one of the most loving things you can do for another. This was his blessing. Live, she said, live, giving me her blessing. Live, whole and undivided. In most cases, I would stop here just telling it like it is. But I had further to go. I climbed onto the pile of earth, the soil, the original body of the world, and started shoveling. My wedding shoes sinking into the loose dirt. there was great cooperation.
That's great. I love that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that poem too. I was thinking about my grandmother recently as, you know, getting near Thanksgiving time.
Uh-huh. Do you actually let people who you're writing about read the poems before you publish them?
Usually I know when I'm done working on a poem. But I usually don't share the poem until it's done. It seems to sort of exhaust some of the energy to actually push it to its conclusion, resolve. But sometimes I know when it's done, and I'll share it with someone.
Did your grandmother read that one?
She didn't read this one. You know, I wrote this after she had passed away. But I remember giving some of my first poems to her. I think I had two or three poems that had to do with her. I have them in my first book. Picture a gate hanging open, let that gate be the sun. She looked at the poems, and, you know, she was in her 90s, and she said, nice. And then she said, why are the words so small?
What did she mean by that?
She could barely see. She was,
the font.
The words were small, yeah, exactly.
I thought she meant you were using small words for talking about big issues. Now, I want to talk about your first collection of poetry. Gorgeous title, Picture a Gate Hanging Open and Let That Gate Be the Sun. That was published because you won a contest, correct?
Right.
To tell us about that, that must have been an amazing time for you.
Well, it was very gratifying. You know, winning a contest, it's kind of like a lottery. And I did feel, you know, very special in a kind of way. But I had a funny conversation with my publisher right after he took the book. He said, you know, I really liked your work. I said, yeah, great, and I'm feeling pretty good. And he said, you know, we got down to the last 50 manuscripts. They all could be published. And I'm thinking, well, I don't feel quite as special as I did just a minute ago.
I wonder, why would he say that to you?
Well, because there's a lot of good poets out there. And, you know, it's hard to distinguish one book from the next, you know. Mm-hmm. And he could have 800 manuscripts or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, yeah, when we get down to the last 20, we couldn't tell one from the other. So, I still felt pretty good. I mean, it wasn't so much that I was better than everyone else. It was more that I had worked on this book for a long time, and I wanted to see it in print. And because of what he said, made me realize how fortunate it was to get picked.
Yeah. Now you worked as a New York State poet in the schools. Tell us about what it feels like to open kids' minds to the idea of poetry, because children's poetry and art, to me, is so profound.
Yeah, you know, that was a real challenge for me. When I first started, I realized, you know, oh, my God, I'm so inspired. Can I make a life of this, a living? And I hooked up with a poet named Michael Jennings, who actually is still pretty active. He lives in Syracuse. And he was a New York State poet in the schools. And I met him in Horseheads. And we were doing some poetry in 7th and 8th grade. And that's really challenging. He was really good at it. You know, he really believed in the sort of oral nature of poetry, that you really are a singer. And it was kind of stunning for me to see him and see the kids listening to him in the classroom. I think it was hard. But, you know, you didn't have to do that much. And kids sort of can find it. Mm-hmm. You know, they understand the power of language. So it was great that they just made a place for that in the schools. You know, it's fun. I mean, to go back and just sort of, again, sort of feel the sanctuary and refuge of those elementary schools, it was just nice.
Yeah, that is like a dusty old memory. If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Jerry Merskin. We're talking about his book, In Flagrante Delecto. And I do want to have you read another piece. This one is called Mother. It's from the collection. And I found this one quite wonderful as well.
Gee, I hope this show is streaming so my mother can go to the library in her house and hear the show, because she'd be delighted. She actually told me, I want you to write a poem about me. And finally, I was old enough not to resist, you know, that kind of directive.
Well, this is a beautiful one.
And so I had to think about her. She was really like someone who invented antiquing. She used to drag us around, you know, from antique shop to antique shop. And, you know, when you're a kid, that's really tedious. But, you know, later on, I came to appreciate her in a different way. Mother. My mother, whose calling is to be a crawler from antique hut to hut, where the junk, having failed in one life, waits to be reincarnated, has purchased two metal garden ornaments, a butterfly and a ladybug, and asks which one I want. My whole life I have wanted not to question my mother. this time having seen her car crawl the hill and labor along the long body of my street, I am nearly able. Thus, through the dregs of winter, when the grass looks drowned and the garden's only sign of life is the foam of frozen parsley or the angry green kale root, a yellow butterfly slinks heavenward along the fence, as it does in summer. High summer, plush and warm and buzzing with real life. It is then in the unrusted trust of the sun that the oversized butterfly's tin body soars, as if it were going to soar endlessly and forever, without wondering, without question, from life to life to life.
That's great. What did your mother think of that?
I think she was satisfied. I think she kind of keeps score. You know, I wrote two or three poems about my dad. And
do you really? Now, I know poetry isn't your only genre. You also are into music. To tell us about that. Are you a musician? Do you write songs?
Well, I'm a beginner, and I'm really, you know, enjoying the pleasure of learning. So a couple of years ago, a friend actually invited me to sort of officiate at his wedding, and he said, you know, afterwards we're going to play some music. And I said, wow. And I remember I played as a kid in junior high school and hadn't played that much. I said, I want to get in on that. So since then, about 3 years, I've been playing a lot. I'm still a beginner, but my bandmates, two friends, Colin Stewart and Evan Williams, formed a little band. We've been playing out a little bit. So it's become a little bit of a midlife obsession. It's a nice...
tell us what you're doing. Do you play guitar? What do you play?
Yeah, I play rhythm guitar. And I actually started adapting some poems to music. And that was really fun. I adapted Frost Stopping by Woods, Randall Jarrell's Death of a Bull Terrier.
Those are other people's work.
Yeah, and then that stimulated some writing of my own songs. And the first ones were pretty basic, but it's coming along, and again, it's a lot of fun.
Isn't that interesting? A lot of people think you can just translate poetry into music, and there's no way that really works.
No, it doesn't work that way.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. You know, I think I feel very comfortable in the craft of poetry, but my songs are pretty basic. I mean, my band member, Evan Williams, he's an amazing songwriter. He's just a kid. The songs are just fantastic.
Yeah, it's a real art.
Yeah,
people
really
just don't realize it.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, you do give a lot of readings of your poetry. Did you find the poems change when you're in front of an audience, or do you change in regard to how you feel about them? Or tell us how that live experience affects you.
I just had a really nice experience this past Wednesday. I read in Plattsburgh, New York. And one of the things is just the sensation of, like, going out of town, being kind of anonymous, letting the poems live on their own. There's almost this feeling like you open your book and you say, hey, what did I write? And you
really?
Find the poems. And, you know,
so you rediscover them.
Well, that's the way they should be. Ezra Pound said, poetry is news that stays news. Mm. And I think they should have a little bit of a shelf life. So they're still living in a way. And there's a reacquaintance, getting reacquainted with that, the poem. And again, I kind of like the poems in this recent book, In Flagrante Delicto. I think I said a lot of things I wanted to say. So it's fun to look through the book and find some poems. I usually try to figure out who I'm reading to and try to connect with them. So sometimes I'll walk around a town a couple hours before I read and talk to people.
Wow.
I like to go into classes, talk to people, you know. It's fun, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it's another way to communicate.
Right.
More concise than just plain conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's almost like, it's not the same sensation as playing music, but you can be together in the moment.
Yeah. I want to have you read another one. It's called On My Way. Can you tell us a little bit about that one? I'm asking you to read surprising poems, it looks like.
Yeah, I haven't ever read this one aloud, I don't think. I like it. I don't know. There's something, I think the word is eschatological, like final things. I don't know if you've ever been on Cascadilla Street. There's a wonderful memorial stone to Alex Haley. I think I was walking by there, and it just put me in this frame of mind about, like, what it's like to pass through this world and be comfortable with that.
It's a beautiful
poem.
That's
where that poem came from. But it also had to do with sort of being in that place where, you know, you're thinking about mortality, but your daily life doesn't really make space for that, and your students aren't really thinking about it very much either. So you're not exactly on the same page. And I think a lot of poets sort of sense their daily sort of exchange with others in their work and their walking to work as a kind of ritual or pilgrimage towards a kind of final understanding. I don't know if that made any sense,
mm-hmm.
but
yes, it does.
I think the poem contains a little of that. Let me read this one. Now, this is a poem I could really say, well, what did I write? On my way. Every day on my way into the world, I pass a small wood and want to be admitted to its quiet truth. There is the slender limb of equanimity, the stalwart trunk of fortitude. So still and gentle and upright and still, their art is limited. They cannot give the name my friends call me. When I arrive at school, I hand out the books, take attendance and my time, looking over the faces of each and every one. There is so much good in a face. It is the first day of the new school year, and these fresh faces lean in to say all beginnings are well-meaning. They believe that if they behave, they'll get to do the promised things. Drive the cars, fly the planes. Soon they'll eat their lunches on sturdy trays, and soon the bell will ring. No, they're not like me. They do not see the noisy room or fret by the wall of understanding. Every day on my way into the world, I pass this wood and wonder if this is the glade I will return to. What would it be to be a silver leaf, a golden shade, to have water's invincible sound? When the day comes, I would like to be summoned by the wild chickadee, the one that speaks to no one. If that's not possible, then a company of geese, or a blossoming pear, or any willing tree will do. I will reserve the right to ask for something in exchange for the name my friends call me, something for the few quiet truths at which I have arrived, something for my earthly yearning.
That's a good and beautiful poem.
Thanks.
And if you were contemplating immortality, this is a great piece to leave behind. Now, you know, I want to talk to you about this too. You obviously teach creative writing and poetry. What do you do to inspire your students?
Well, sometimes you know, I think that would be actually that would kind of be a burden. I think the students have had inspirations, and it's a matter of sort of finding the expression. It's more like trying to find the medium which will allow them a maximum amount of expression. So I'm not trying to give them an original experience. Also, sometimes we'll play around. Mm. You know, sometimes we'll do some in class play, just to sort of knock them out of their sort of daily routine. But I don't see my role as sort of trying to inspire as much as to share, to encourage, to turn on their ears a little bit to the qualities of language, the potential in the music of language, to get them to understand how we in poetry tell story through image. So we read a lot, and one of my goals is just to get them to see that there's so many different forms of poetry and to find the one that works for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of writers tell me that they have to shut off the inner critic, especially in beginning writers. So do you find that for yourself too? Are you somebody sitting there judging before you write, saying, I don't know if I can handle this, or you know, I don't know if I should approach this?
In writing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant in terms of reading my students' writing.
Oh, no, that's an entirely different subject.
The inner critic. I think if you develop a daily practice, then it's just that, it's just practice. And sometimes you can reduce some of that tension by just enjoying the process, and you're just making a space for your own reflection. It's something you do for yourself. It's like exercise. I don't expect a lot to happen at any one moment. I usually don't feel like there's a deadline, although I'm working with a photographer in town now, and she's giving me a deadline. I have to do something this week. So that's kind of hard. So I think, yeah, if it was really pressurized and someone was expecting something, it would be difficult. you know, sometimes I think, oh, they're going to invite me to the White House, and I got to write a poem. Oh, man, I couldn't do that. Forget that.
That would be a tough one.
Yeah, but yeah,
I don't know how Maya Angelou and some of those people were able to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if those were their best poems either. But you know, you know, some pressure helps a little bit. But again, it has to do with sitting there enjoying the process. You're kind of making a mess. And then you're figuring out what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's most of the work. I usually work on 20 or 30 things at once.
Do you really?
So there's not a pressure on any one moment or poem.
Uh-huh. Did you spend weeks on one poem? Does it take you a long time to finish and polish? Or?
Oh, yeah. You know, sometimes I'll work on something for years and it's just in the back of my mind. Sometimes I'll use things from other poems and new poems. But it's not like that process of trying to finish one thing. Usually I'll just work on a lot of things and then, you know, some things get done. New things get added to the batch.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But yeah, that was a good question. That was a good craft question. So I think it really is a process and learning how to deal with, you know, the ongoingness of it. And I wouldn't say the mess, but it's you know, writing is pretty... It's a messy process.
Oh, it's a form of communication and music in so many ways.
Yeah. Well, when you're done, you have a product that doesn't really resemble the process in some way, and that's what you're trying to create.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we only have about a minute and a half left. Can you tell us what you're working on now? A new collection? Any new themes that you're working on?
Again, I have like an ongoing relationship. I was really gratified with this last book, and because I had two books, I didn't feel the pressure of, I have to keep publishing, So I took some time off. It's been about a year, and I thought, I haven't been writing, but I actually was. I was writing. I'm kind of interested in moving into a slightly different space, something more like flash fiction, concise literary nonfiction, where I'm doing a little more storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's still poetry. The pieces resolve poetically. I didn't bring any with me. They're more like short story, but again, they're not fiction. Poets don't usually make up a lot of stuff. I have a problem. I can't make up anything. I mean, silly things I can say, you know. And then he did a backflip. And then she was eaten by that lion. You know, I can say things, and I can see if it goes anywhere. But usually I'm working from my own experience.
Yeah, well, poetry is a very definite language. It's probably hard to get out of the box of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So can you give some contact information? I know you have a website for people to get in touch with you or maybe get copies of your book.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. I have a website. It's jerrymerskin.us. I didn't think I was an EDU, and I'm for sure I wasn't a .com. So
spell it out for people.
JerrymerskinUS.
That's great. Well, Jerry Merskin, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, and I do hope you keep writing, not just flash fiction, but continue with the poetry. It's gorgeous stuff.
Oh, thanks, Tish.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.